Please note that this podcast is intended to give advice to ostomates. The information given is based on personal experiences and should not be taken as clinical advice. Please consult with your stoma care nurse if you are in need of medical advice. Welcome to Let's Talk episode 9. This podcast is sponsored by Pelican Healthcare, a manufacturer of stoma care products and their pouch, the Pelican Moda V. You can head over to their website, www.pelicanhealthcare.co.uk, and have a look over there with regards to any products that we mention in the show. Today, I am joined by Rachel, aka Gutsy Mum, and I am your host, Louise, and I go under Crohn's Fighting. Today, we're going to be talking about something different, and it's not widely mentioned about children and stomas. Sometimes we see it, sometimes we don't. But Rachel's son Jake is getting—he's—is he seven now?
Nearly, yes, nearly seven.
Yeah, he's nearly seven, and you've been dealing with Jake for a stoma for quite a while, haven't you?
Yeah, from 2 weeks old now. Yeah,
2 weeks old. If I remember rightly, any issues that they may have and whether or not they go into a NICU, surgery can only be done after a certain time, can't it, with regards to children, because newborns can be considered as weak and not able to withstand obviously surgery, sedation, that kind of thing. So there's always like a magic, I can't remember what the magic number is, but there's like a magic number for days or weeks, isn't there, before that they can have that kind of surgery?
Yeah, it's quite typical so if a newborn does need stoma surgery, they're not going to do it straight away. They're going to do washouts, daily washouts, whilst they build up their strength, gain some weight. So for Jake, he was having 3 washouts a day. I had a C-section and then was blue lighted with Jake to the nearest hospital in Cardiff where they had children with Hirschsprungs, so they had experience. And as soon as he came with his symptoms, they were like, yeah, classic Hirschsprungs. And it was kind of like they were old hats at it. It was right into a routine of 3 washouts daily. And he was taken into the treatment room. They would always encourage me not to go in and see it. I think they were very conscious that as a new mum and a first-time mum, already having your baby born and knowing straight away that there's something wrong and it's not going to be that picture book scenario that you dreamt of. I think they were quite sensitive to the fact that, you know, I probably wasn't dealing with it as well as I was pretending to. Like, I like to keep things quite positive, quite upbeat, and tell everyone I'm fine. And when you've got this little baby that's suffering so much and having such a crap start in life, you think, right, well, you can't dwell on it and be upset, because you need to straight away, you need to be there for them and be strong. So I was very grateful when they were saying, like, no, let us do this. You just stay by the bed and we'll go and take him into the treatment room and do the washouts. But it doesn't mean you can't hear the crying from inside that room. And that is something that does not leave you, for sure.
It's difficult because obviously Maisie was born healthy, but I've had friends that have had children where they've had to go to the NICU and they've had to have quite some major surgery. A friend of mine's child was born with an imperforate anus, and I know that she spent a lot of time living next door to the hospital in the parents' hotel, as they call it. And it's hard because, you like you say, you kind of have this whole idyllic thing in your head when you're pregnant, don't you, that you're going to have a new baby and things are going to be fine. I think movies have a lot to answer for.
Oh, hell yeah. And Instagram and social media and all this.
Nothing with a newborn baby is perfect. They have a feeding schedule that's off whack, nappy changes, dressed, bath, and not to mention first-time mum neurosis, that can happen. And to be honest, 9 times out of 10, we're just mainly knackered. And I never experienced the first 3 weeks of Maisie because of what happened to me. So being a new parent and you feeling relatively healthy and having a baby that's not well, you kind of feel, you feel a lot of guilt for it, don't you? It's...
Yeah, that's the most difficult part for me, because obviously Jake inherited Hirschsprung's disease directly from me because I have it. And I was told in genetic testing, it would be about a 1 in 10 chance he'd have it. And then I never used to buy into the whole mother's instinct thing. I thought it was a load of BS, to be honest, if we're going to be completely honest. I was like, some kind of hippie stuff, like, you know, that's not real, you know. But when I was pregnant, I just remember having a very strong feeling that the baby was going to be the same as me. And I didn't say it out loud. One, I didn't want to freak out my husband, because I already had my steps and all, and he didn't so much as cough then, still doesn't now. But I remember speaking to my mum and saying, I think it's going to happen to me is what happened to you. And literally, like clockwork, Jake was born, wouldn't feed, tummy distended, couldn't poo. And straight away, I just knew he had it. And it was as clear as day. But the one thing I did face is that the members of staff in the hospital would not believe me. And I'm sure I'm not the first new mum that isn't believed at things like that. I was very calm, and I was like, right, I really think Jake needs to be tested. I think he's going to have the same as me. He's not feeding, but you had the kind of breastfeeding brigade coming round. Oh no, it's because you're a new mum. It's because you're tired. It's because you're this. And I was like, no, it is not that. And yeah, it went from me being calm and collected to shouting and screaming for them to go and get a consultant and a doctor, because I knew exactly what was wrong with him, and they would not listen to me. And, you know, I had my C-section scar was not the way it should have been. It hadn't been closed up properly. So, you know, stress and any exertion and movement is not going to help that either. But I was getting out of bed and going up to the desk and going, you need to get me someone now. And yeah, that's kind of the way I've always faced things with Jake, to be honest. I just won't accept no for an answer. I won't stop nagging. I won't stop fighting. I won't stop. I don't know. I suppose in some respects it can seem as a bit of an aggressive approach, but I found unless you ask, you don't get. And unless you nag, you don't get. And I found that's the best way I can get the things he needs. And there are some mums I've seen that say are waiting for appointments and waiting for surgeries and all that. And I'm thinking, oh my God, you just got to ring more, nag more, go to the building, say you won't leave until they listen to you. And again, it seems quite aggressive, but unfortunately, as harsh as it is, your kid is not the only one that's ill. And your kid is nowhere near as ill as probably the worst kid in the county. So unless you shout and scream for them, you're not going to get anywhere.
No, it's difficult, isn't it? And it's, I think sometimes there are a lot of things that can be put down to first mum neurosis or supposedly not coping or just trying to find an excuse. But nine times out of 10, you know, if there's something wrong with your child, you just know. And I think sometimes a mother's intuition and a mother's instinct normally trumps what they turn around and say. It's not a case of, oh, you're being neurotic. It's a case of, oh God, she was right.
Yeah. I mean, it went from no one coming to check on Jake to him being rushed to intensive care with like a group of 12 doctors around. God, I'd done incubation. What is that thing called? That box. That's it. That box that they're in. Loads of lines and things coming out of him. Them all huddled around. And you know then that, oh, they're taking me seriously now. Why did it take 6 hours? You know, and it's things like that. You think, you know what, if you had just taken that time to listen to me, maybe he didn't need all them people around him. Maybe he didn't need to be blue lighted. I mean, and also the fact that I already have the condition, and surely some of the best people are the ones that are living with it. And my mum, I displayed the same symptoms when I was born as what my mum saw in me and what I was seeing in Jake. I mean, I don't know how it can have been any more clearer, to be honest. But anyway, that was 7 years ago. So I'm thankful to say that I do not set foot in the hospital anymore. And if I do have to go in there, it still triggers me now, to be honest. I don't want to go anywhere near there after what happened.
And how old was Jake when he had his stoma surgery? A
couple of weeks old.
It's crazy to think that he had to go through all of that in the space of 2 weeks.
And it's kind of like, you know, we got family that live in Leicester, and they, you know, you expect to be at home and all the family come to you and have cuddles and cutches and it's all lovely, but they were having to come to the hospital and then see the baby in a box and not be able to touch him or pick him up. And it's just, you know, we've got photos and that, and I'm glad they were taken, but you can really see the sadness in everyone's eyes. Like, it's not a nice thing. It's not like, oh, look at those new photos. Oh, it's like, oh my God, that was such a horrific time. And you can see I'm smiling, but I've got one of those faces where I just can't hide what I'm, as you know, I can't hide what I'm thinking. And it's written all over my face how devastated I am. But just got to get on with it, haven't you? You haven't got a choice.
Yeah, but I think we all live with that guilt. I live with the guilt that maybe when Maisie gets older, she'll have what I have. And anytime that she says to me that she's got a stomach bug or a stomach pain, or she's having a particularly bad time with her period, there's parts of me that always go to endo and Crohn's. And then she takes a couple of paracetamol. She's like, oh, I'm fine now. Panic over.
Oh, God, yeah. Yeah.
That still doesn't alleviate my guilt, because there's still part of me that's wondering, well, maybe she's experiencing this because she's got it from me, because, as you know, it's hereditary as well. And it's
and then there's when they have kids, if their kids have it, and then you'd have to watch your child go through the same as you.
Yeah. And it's difficult, because my mum's always been quite neurotic with me, but I was a preemie baby. I was born at 27 weeks. I spent a lot of time in an incubator. I came home. Both me and my twin brother had asthmatic bronchitis. We was in and out of the hospital like a yo-yo. We was born in September, and by the beginning of December, my brother died. Asthmatic bronchitis, but they put it down to a cot death. Then spent another 2 months in an incubator up in some hospital somewhere. And I always think that my mum's being a bit neurotic with me, but when I see and speak to other people that have been through it with their own children, I then can kind of understand why my mum is as neurotic as what she is, even though I'm now 37. And it's just like, I don't think, unless you've actually been in that situation, you can sympathize and you can have all the empathy in the world with the person that's going through that at the time. But unless you've actually been in that situation, you don't understand. And I like the fact that you use two separate platforms, and you use your platform to raise awareness for Jake, because there are going to be other parents that are going through that, other mothers that are going through that experience. And like you say, you only get what you ask for, and you can only get the help if you keep pushing. And I mean, how was Jake after his stoma surgery? Did he improve quickly, or did it take more time? Because this is the reality, isn't it, for parents that have children that are born with Hirschsprung's disease.
The thing is, it's like with most bowel conditions, no one child is the same. So Jake's had quite a difficult journey compared to what I had. So I think the biggest thing is that when you bring them home after stoma surgery, it's just never going to be like you thought it was going to be. I mean, just putting a stoma bag on such a little person who isn't going to know to keep still, who has got no control over their output, who, you know, we were still trying to figure out what was the best feed and what they were allergic to or not allergic to. So their output was really high, and it was just a nightmare. And there was just like, we had to have carpets redone. Like, you can just imagine why. It was just literally everywhere. Like, the amount of diffusers and plugins I would buy, because I was so paranoid that when people would come and visit, they'd just be hit with this smell, which, you know, is normal anyway for a newborn. Their poo smells and they all poo, whatever, whatever. But it just was so much poo. It was just so much. And
dealing with several poonamis when they're having a bad stomach and having to change those really nasty nappies. I'll be honest, I don't think that's the thing I've ever heaved at. I've always been able to handle the poo aspect. It's the vomit that I can't do.
Yeah.
I don't do sick. I can do blood, guts, pee.
Yeah.
Cannot do vomit.
I'm the same. And I suppose it's like, you know, trying to like, you know, you cannot predict when the bag is going to leak. You can't predict when it's going to be full. You can't, none of them things. But as an adult, and when it's yourself, you get to learn when and how and, you know, the diet and all that. But when it's a newborn, none of that applies. Like, I mean, the way that I dealt with it was I had a box for stoma changing downstairs, a box for stoma changing upstairs, changing mat in both places, so that wherever we were in the house, we were close to somewhere to change the bag. But then in the night, like, he didn't sleep till he was 4 and a half through the night. So as the months and years went by, the sleep deprivation, I swear to God, I was going literally insane. I've just never expected, out of all of it, is the sleep deprivation that I found the hardest. And I always like joke that, like, when he's 9, I will then be my normal, if that's even possible, self, because it'll have taken me that long to get back the sleep that I lost, because I don't know how I functioned. I don't know how, like, I could, you know, like, I think I find speaking to friends and that, as you get older, the more you forget where you put things and you lose your train of thought. But like, I put a can of polish in the fridge, and then I'd find it a day after and think, why did I put that in the fridge? Or I'd go into a room and be like, I literally have no idea why I'm in here. And it was just the sleep deprivation. It affected everything, my mood, relationships, like, you know, so being sociable and just, oh my God, which is normal for a new mum anyway, isn't it? Let's be honest. But I was in the hospital minimum once a week, and he's had 10 operations now. And the first 3 years, we were just living in that hospital, me and Jake. And yeah, that was kind of our normal. So then I'd have to be really, like, really have a talk with myself and make sure that if someone was saying they were tired, or if someone said, oh, my baby's sick, or they've got a bug or whatever, I had to make sure that I told myself to not feel bitter and not feel, you know, bothered by their comments, because I would always think, like, in baby groups or something, like, literally, you're moaning because you haven't had a week's sleep, like, really, like, and of course it would be all over my face, but I would have to internalize me saying it, because everyone's struggle is relative, isn't it? Everyone's got their own thing, and that's how I've always dealt with it. This is ours. This is the thing that we need to deal with. Everyone's got something. This just happens to be ours. And that's the approach I've always taken to it, to be honest.
I'll be fair, everybody's struggles are relative and relevant, but at the same time, they're still not dealing with what you're dealing with. And sometimes people should maybe kind of check what they're saying before they say it. There's nothing worse than being a sleep deprived parent, and yours is way worse. It's like when Maisie was teething, I still had machines and TPN attached to me, and I'd got to the space of like six days, and she'd been up all night, every night, and I'd got to the point of I was that tired, I felt drunk. There was no way I was getting,
yeah, that's a good way of describing it, actually. Yeah, feeling drunk, like you're not really there.
there was no way that I was going to get behind the wheel of my car to try and drive her about with a nighttime to get her to sleep, because I could have ended up causing someone an injury by falling asleep behind the wheel myself. And, you know, and on top of a child's normal ailments, you've got dealing with a stoma, and then you've got Jake's feeding tube, haven't you, which is another one, or was that a later addition?
That was a later addition, because he had a bad case of gastroenteritis when he was 18 months, and he just couldn't get over it, and he was losing 4 litres of stool a day, and they were running all these tests and they didn't understand why. And then I said, oh, have you checked for allergies? Like, what about celiac disease? Because I read it on probably a blog or something somewhere. I always find these nuggets of information on social media, which is why I started mine, and I will always champion them. And they tested him, and he was, and it came out of nowhere because none of us have it and we've been tested. And so he was undiagnosed for all that time. So as well as Hirschsprung's disease, the effects of having no colon, being susceptible to every bug. He also was allergic to gluten, wheat and barley, which we didn't know. So when we were weaning him, blaming it on the Hirschsprungs, it wasn't that. It's because every time he was eating something with them in, it was giving crippling pain. And that was, it affects your behaviour, your sleep, everything, your cognitive abilities, everything. So, yeah, he had to have gastrostomy surgery then after 12 weeks of TPN, because they put him on the TPN to rest his gut because he needed that long of no gluten, wheat or barley because it was affecting him so badly. And then he couldn't just go from TPN just to eating orally again. He had to have gastrostomy surgery to kind of bridge that gap, and his appetite had been suppressed from the TPN. So he had to have artificial feed via the tube then. So then I became a tubey mum, and then it was, you know, following around on a pump three times a day. Yeah, so now we've got to a point where he doesn't rely on the tube for feed, but he does for medicines, which is brilliant. But then, of course, when they're ill, like he has been this week, I can use it for Dioralyte to get it into him fast overnight, which is a massive help, which is a blessing because people don't have that luxury. But yeah, he hasn't had a typical start, and it's been horrendous for him. But as you've seen, you would never know there's anything wrong with him. Like, you wouldn't ever in a million years just looking at him. Yeah, it's incredible, really. He has no idea how amazing he is. No idea.
Can I ask, how long has he got to have that tube in? Is there any point that he can have that tube removed?
So until he can take his medicines orally, he can keep it. He doesn't have to have it. If he decided tomorrow, mum, I want to have all my medicines orally, he could have it taken out, but he has 21 doses a day. And for a kid who's got an adverse aversion to eating, that's going to be a problem. And then the sheer volume of them is a problem. So actually I've been trying to like give him little, what's those little pink sweets? Those little tiny things. What are they called? Minions. Is that it?
The Millions. Yeah.
Minions.
Millions.
Minions. Yeah. Millions. That's it. So I'd be like, oh, Jake, see if you can swallow one of these and we can, you know, so I've been trying to do a lot of food play with him to kind of train him to be able to swallow tiny little things like that. Obviously, I've checked it with the dietitian and the doctor and it's safe to do so. Don't do it with your child unless you've had advice. Just sort of to get used to it because he likes the idea of doing it. But then when he goes to try a tablet orally, it's horrible for him. And it's not nice. Like, plenty of adults have problems taking tablets. I don't know if I mean, I would take 21 a day if I had to, but it wouldn't be nice. And when you're a kid, if you've got an option to not do it, you're not going to do it, are you? So at the moment, they've advised me that while he's still little and he's still having these bad tummy bugs and that, and it's really good to have for being able to administer Dioralyte. So we're not pushing it. And kind of as he gets older, is graduating more to him, he'll have to start, you know, he's got a voice, he's got a bloody loud voice like his mother. So he's, you know, he's got, it'll start being that he takes more ownership of these decisions. You know, if he wants to try taking medicines orally, he can. And then when he's comfortable and confident he can, then he can get rid of the tube. And that'll be his decision now, not mine, because he's the one that's got to take them.
Yeah. Can I ask, so he had his stoma surgery. You got to the point of managing his stoma fine. Then he went in and had a feeding tube and a gastrocop after 18 months. What was life like in a day for you then when he had the new tube put in?
To be honest, it was a relief because I was trying to get him to eat and he wouldn't want to all the time because it was making him suffer, which we didn't know because he couldn't talk. So I remember they sat us down in the hospital in the playroom and they said, look, we think he needs gastrostomy surgery. We can't let him just go back to eating orally for now. And it was devastating. It was like, I couldn't breastfeed because I had mastitis because of stress when he was born, which I really wanted to do, which I felt guilty about. And now he had to have a feeding tube. So it's like every point where something so natural, like feeding your child, there was a barrier and it just wasn't allowed to happen. It just felt like another fail. But the thought of the surgery was really scary. And he'd already had a bag. It was just like, oh, another thing. But then the more you talk about it, you do your research and they gave us one to feel. And it's a very soft plastic. Like, it looks quite offensive to look at and like really hard and harsh to have in your tummy and sit in your tummy, but it's really soft and flexible. And when you ask him, he says he doesn't even feel it. Like, for me, I forget I have a stoma bag. Like 99.9% of the time, I don't even think about it or even remember I have one. And I believe how Jake feels about his feeding tube.
And with regards to the feeding tube, how did you manage once you come out of hospital with that? Because I remember seeing some of your posts about the looks that you used to get going into the disabled toilets and kind of having to justify using the facilities to help Jake with his tube and his stoma.
Yeah, I mean, when going out of the house would be a mission because you'd have the pump in a backpack. Then you'd have another bag with all the stoma changing equipment. Like going out to the house with a stoma as an adult, you take a little toiletry bag, something so you can do a change. But when it's a newborn, a baby or a toddler, you've got to take changes of clothes. You've got to take a towel. You've got to take loads of extra things that you wouldn't have to as an adult. So the amount of luggage, as I call it, that I'd have to take about with me, I'd look like a pack horse. So then when you literally, it'd be like, if you leave that buggy, it's going to go down. Using the toilet and that, obviously I'd have to use disabled facilities for Jake, and the looks I'd get, and you know, it would take everything in me not to snap back at people and turn around and give them a piece of my mind, because I think, you know what, they're ignorant, they don't understand what's going on, they haven't actually said it to my face, they're just giving me a filthy look, so I'll just leave it be. But when the odd occasion when someone would say anything, I would reply. I wouldn't be rude, but I would correct them, shall we say, in what their beliefs were. Is that putting it politely?
Yeah, but that's the reality for some parents, because the problem that you've got with Hirschsprung's is, again, it's an invisible illness, isn't it?
Yeah, and that's the problem. They'd see a mum with, you know, a toddler, a baby, whatever, and see all these bags and think, they probably thought, oh, she's been shopping, she's had a shopping spree, look at all them bags, oh, she's going into the disabled toilet just because she got a buggy and all her shopping with her. No, love, I'm going into the disabled toilet because my little one's bag is gone. There's nowhere I can change it. Even most of the public disabled toileting facilities are rubbish, and I'd still have to put down a towel and a Conti pad and try and make it work in there, let alone if I had to use a typical toilet cubicle. It would just be a nightmare. And I remember being in Asda once, and there was this elderly gentleman, was a cleaner there, and he just finished cleaning the disabled toilets. I think Jake's bag had gone or something. And bearing in mind now, he's still losing about 2 litres of poo a day, which is very high output. So anyone would have, you know, would have to be emptying it or changing it more frequently than others. And I think he said to me, oh, the other ones are open by there. I went, yeah, I know, but I'm using these ones. And he went, yeah, but you need to use the other ones. I went, oh, do I? Oh, right. You know that, do you? Because last time I checked, I need to use these ones. And I thought, let it go, Rach, let it go. Don't, you know, just don't say anything.
The problem is as a parent, though, a lot of the baby changing facilities are not fit for purpose. It's an old changing mat that has seen better days.
Yeah.
And the amount of dirt and grime that you get in a baby changing facility is gross. Because
it's disgusting. CSI, love a bit of CSI. I'd love to get one of them blue lights and put them around a baby changing room. Can you imagine how much that room would light up?
Nope, don't want to know.
But then it's just like gross. Like, and that's coming from someone who, you know, changes a stoma bag in there. Like, I know for damn sure that me doing Jake's bag, I'd be far cleaner and leave it far cleaner than when I went into most of them. Like, and when you've got a baby who's really vulnerable, you don't want to change their bags in places like that because you don't want them picking up anything and making them worse. No. So, you know, I would not use them unless I absolutely had to. That's for sure. It's like, you know, yeah, a lot of us, I mean, like I've done stuff with Pelican before about, signs for toilets about invisible illnesses and that. No typical person wants to use them toilets. Why would you want to have to use them? I don't want to have to use them. I would love to just stroll in and use the other toilets all the time, but that is just not my reality.
If you ever tried to tried to empty your bag when you can't get your elbows out in the cubicle. The fact is, most of us have to strip down. We have to take a coat off. We have to hang our bag up. The logistics of using a normal cubicle to empty your bag is actually quite difficult, because you've got the things like backsplash, whether you're standing or sitting. I know a lot of people, I know some of the men say that they kneel in the toilets when they're
empty. Why do you do that?
Who kneels on a public
absolute toilet? Mingers, you are. If any of you are listening, find another way. That is disgusting.
But there are a lot of logistics to dealing with your bag as an adult, let alone having an adult with a stoma bag and a child with a stoma bag.
Yeah.
And a feeding tube. And I know that feeding tubes have to be 100% hygienic and clean and sterile for you to be able to, before you administer anything, because anything can be trapped up the tube liner. I mean, how do you manage that?
Like I said, you just get on with it. I mean, for a lot of the time, he had a Hickman line as well, which for anyone that's had one or knows about them, there's a very high risk of infection from them, which can lead to life-altering complications. So, you know, to the point where you can't even have a bath without properly covering them, and the risk of even water going down them. It got to a point where I think you get into a flow of it and then it's your new normal and you just do it on autopilot. And then you'd get looks of people, like, you know, where their mouth is open looking at you and you're like, oh, someone good looking behind me. So they're like, oh, what are they looking at? And then you realize, oh, they're looking at me. Why? And then you remember, oh, it's because I'm giving him his meds for the tube or something. Or, it's good. You know, you just, I think you get to a point where it's so normal and natural for you. And like I said, I was a first time mum. This literally is all I've ever known. I've never changed a dirty nappy. Like, never of Jake's. He's never had one. It's not been a reality ever. So, you know, and he ain't ever, you know, the likelihood of me ever having to do one of him is like zilch now. And I suppose not a lot of mums can say that, but that is my reality. So it's normal to me. So
let's talk about the realities of a Hickman line, because they don't get spoken about enough.
No, they don't.
For anybody that's listening and anybody that hasn't had a Hickman line, Hickman line goes on your chest, but it has to go into the main artery that is above your heart. And what they do when they put in a Hickman line, they use these funny little metal stitches, I think is the correct term for what they do, until it heals over itself, and then they take the stitches out, and then you just have to cover the Hickman line. But the amount of training before being allowed to go home the Hickman line is crazy, because it has to be so sterile, because it's going through a main artery, because it is going past your heart to get the feed into your system. It's just absolutely crazy. I was in hospital 3 months and I'd only just about learned how to take care of my Hickman line before they released me from hospital. And when I was released from hospital, I was still going back up on the daily in the mornings to have my bag changed, until they was fully sure that I was competent enough to do it myself. But the only reason they let me go home was because Maisie was getting too big to keep in the side room. The Hickman lines don't get spoken about enough, and it's the rate, the feed. You have to learn how to use the machine. You have to learn how to plug the bag up. You have to learn how to clean it, how to detach it, because there's little caps that go on the bottom of the port. It's just crazy. It just does not get spoken about enough at all.
Can I ask you, because obviously Jake was so little, how did it, like, when we talk about bags, some people say they can't forget it's there and they always feel it there, whereas others, I'm in the camp of, I forget I even have it and I can't feel it. Did you, with your Hickman line, were you always very aware of it? Was it?
I used to I used to catch it all the time because of where they've put it. They say, like, when you get dressed, that you have to try and wear tops to avoid it and not cover it up. But the problem that you've got, when I had my Hickman line, it was the height of winter when I was released from hospital. There was no way I was going home in a
winter. Going around in a boob tube, loving the winter, are you? Not going to happen.
I wasn't going to go home just with a vest top on. So trying to put a jumper on it in itself was a whole new, like, gymnastics required to not catch the tube. And the thing is, they put the dressings on, don't they, with the Hickman line, but the dressing always unpeels. It doesn't matter what you do,
how
dry you cut, try and clean it, within 2 days the dressing goes and you've got to put a new one on.
And changing the dressing is like a military operation. Oh my god, like,
because you can't rip
and like you move it or dislodge it, there's no thing about it, you're having surgery again, aren't you? So it's that, I think that was probably the most daunting part of everything. I mean, I can deal with a stoma with my eyes closed, I can deal with a feeding tube with my eyes closed, but that Hickman line, that's the one thing that made me think, oh, okay, this is, you know, something serious. Not that the rest isn't, but that is something I would, even if I felt like I could, I would not touch that with my eyes closed.
I'm actually quite amazed, because I see a lot of people having ports put in for chemotherapy and medications. And I'm surprised that they have yet to design a port that you can attach a tube to. Because surely having an internal port for a Hickman line would be more hygienic and less invasive and more portable, shall we say, because that's why it's called a port, because it's portable, you can carry it about with you. I'm quite surprised that they haven't designed that yet to basically be having a feed that is basically saving your life and keeping you ticking over until they take it out or they find something else. But I mean, how did you manage with Jake and the Hickman line? Because it's normal, some people lose a lot of weight when they have the Hickman line in, whereas other people gain it. And how did you manage with that with Jake? Because obviously, as you know, a stoma changes size, and obviously the abdomen changes size with weight gain and weight loss. With Jake having the Hickman line and the feeding tube and a stoma, did the Hickman line cause issues with anything else?
No, so he went like the Michelin man. He went like a blimp. Like, it's funny looking back now, but at the time it wasn't. But he literally looks like you've just put a load of helium in him and blown him up. I mean, it's hilarious. When he's 21, these photos are coming out to play, I tell you. Like, that. When he gets his first proper girlfriend, I can't wait to crack all these out when he annoys me. But yeah, no, he just blew up. But I think because he'd struggled to gain weight for so long, it exaggerated it even more. Because it's like, you know, like when you try and lose a bit of weight or whatever, like, you know, they say it takes 6 weeks for you to notice, another 6 weeks for others to notice, la, la, la. Well, you don't notice as much when you see them every day, do you? Yeah. And you look at photos, you think, Jesus Christ, kid, you look like you've been bulking, like proper on the shakes. Like he's like proper massive. But obviously you don't just have a Hickman line and don't get monitored. There's a lot of intervention that comes with it, especially when it's a small child. So they would tweak it and change the dosage and la, 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 la. And eventually then he only had it for 12 weeks. He's got the scars. He's got the loveliest little scars. They're so cute.
Yeah, they're like, I think it's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, it's 6, because they always use 2 stitches on the bottom, 3 at the top, and then you've got the one in the middle where the line went through.
Yeah, I mean, Jake's is a bit higher than yours. His is on his neck almost. And I don't know whether that's because of the age that he had it. But, I mean, you know, when it comes to dating and that, he's got some serious bragging rights with the scars he has, I'm telling you. There's plenty of talking points for that kid. I mean...
Oh, I love him. What was the other thing that you was telling me about? So you was telling me, I remember the most random things, and I remember talking to you about this via Messenger the other day, and I was saying to you about Jake's eating and that you got sent a load of things in lockdown
because
you couldn't get them from the shops, and I couldn't remember what it was, because it was like PDA and ARFID and some other things. And I was asking you, and I was like, I remember you saying to me about something, but I just remember the comment about the waffles.
So at the start of lockdown, Jake was just starting to want to eat again. And his food, his range of foods he would eat was very, very small. And the main food that he would have is potato waffles. So when lockdown happened and everyone nuts buying stuff, of course, if you've got a kid who only eats certain things, that was a time to panic. So I would, you know, go to different supermarkets, try and find them, and I wouldn't find them. And I'd just panic. And we don't have a massive freezer. And then I was thinking, right, I need to buy a freezer. I need to go and find them and buy them all. And I didn't want to turn into that person, but I was well on my way. And then I just thought, you know what? I'm gonna email Birdseye. So I just emailed them and I just said, look, can you tell me when and where you're going to be having deliveries in the next week? Just because I'm really struggling to get potato waffles. And I said about Jake, and it'd just be brilliant to get a heads up. I said, I know his favouritism and it's probably not legal or allowed, but I can't not ask, because you know, you're feeling pretty desperate at this point. And literally, they just sent me an email back saying, what's your address? We'll send you some, don't worry. And I thought, oh, well, you know, that's not why I emailed. But I thought, you know what, a free box of waffles, that's wicked. They turned up with like some freezer boxes on a DPD van of like 200 waffles. I had to go around like two other family members' houses to fill up their freezers of waffles because I just didn't have the freezer space. And I think the photo's still on my Instagram, and Jake's just, his face when he saw this delivery. We made a pyramid out of them. It was insane. It was, it was amazing. But I know for a lot of parents of children with eating disorders during COVID, is a pretty stressful time on top of everything else, because a lot of things just weren't available.
Now Jake's eating a bit more and a bit more mobile and school and everything else. How is he now with the ARFID? Because ARFID is another thing that doesn't get spoken about and mainly gets mocked in the media, because you've seen the stories with regards to ARFID in the media and the comments that you get on there about, oh, it's because the parents aren't forcing them to eat their veggies and not forcing them to eat this. They're being picky eaters. They're basically being, basically being catered for by mum and dad, and mum and dad don't care as long as they eat. But that's not the case with ARFID, is it? ARFID is more of an, because of the issues that Jake has had and that he has been through, ARFID isn't an aversion to food, is it? It's scared of eating it, so therefore they only have a set amount of safe foods that they know that they can eat, that isn't going to cause them pain, isn't going to upset their stomach, and that they're happy with eating because that's their safe food. And it doesn't get spoken about enough, does it?
No. So ARFID stands for Avoidance Food Refusal Intake Disorder. So one of the main causes of it is medical trauma. So Jake definitely ticks that massive box. So because of not being diagnosed with celiac soon enough, and because of all the other things that happened, that subconsciously has made him have a very difficult relationship with food compared to, say, you or I. It's above everything else, the eating has been the hardest part of parenting him, because, like I said earlier, feeding your child always feels like it should be the most natural, easiest thing to do. Yes, you've got your picky eaters and kids who don't want vegetables, so on and so on. But when at some point you can't even get your child to eat one crisp or one cracker or anything, it's such a scary feeling, because without food and without drink, ultimately in your head you think, well, if they don't do this, they're going to die. And there's no quick fix. You can't force your child to eat. Even, you know, you just can't. And the dietitian always said to me, you need to, instead of thinking about what your child's eaten in that one day, think about what they've eaten over a week. So like, say one day your kid might like stuff their face and be starving, and then the next day they won't want so much because they haven't eaten so much. And so they've always said to try and look at it over a larger picture. But as soon as I started keeping food diaries and started, you know, banging over the evidence and that and saying, ain't as simple as that, I think it's this, boom, 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 they were like, oh yeah, okay, it's, you know, it's not as simple as that. I mean, I've part of all the, I know you're part of a lot of groups on Facebook for things, and I am as well. And Alfred is some of the groups I'm part of. And I mean, the stories are heartbreaking. I mean, Jake is nowhere near the average worst child who suffers with it, thankfully. But yeah, I mean, you just got to get to the point where you think, you know what, I can't control the situation. It's something that's going to take a long time to fix. And well, there's no fix. It's a behavior. It's a mental condition. It's the wiring in their brain that reacts to food and eating is just traumatized from what they've been through. And unfortunately, things like that takes a long, long time to unpick and unravel. And there's not, it's, you know, he could suffer with this forever. There's no evidence to say suddenly he's going to wake up one day and think, you know what, I'm cool with food, I'll eat whatever. Like, he might not ever be, and you've got to live with that.
You know, if you think about it, though, Jake kind of, it, not that he's missed milestones, but with everything with the stoma surgeries and then the feeding tube and then the Hickman line, and, you know, in such a small period of his life, he didn't do what his counterparts were doing, because there's a reason why, that, well, they say that you shouldn't wean a baby until a year old. Obviously, we're not medical professionals. There will always be a disclaimer, but the majority of us start weaning babies at 6 months old. You know, if they're ready for food, they're ready for food. But all children have a learning process with regards to food textures, tastes. And there's also a thing, like a caveman thing as well, with babies and humans as a general whole, whereas if we see specific colours with foods, it's kind of seen as a danger food. So things like when people were eating out in the wild and going foraging and picking berries and stuff, certain colours meant that you couldn't eat it because you could end up dead eating it and that kind of thing. So you can kind of understand where Jake's aphid has come from, because the food was causing him pain, and then he wasn't eating for a long time, and it's just kind of had a safe established diet of what he knows is safe for him. And it's like Maisie went through all the weaning things, and like to this day I still can't get Maisie to eat shepherd's pie or cottage pie at home. She'll eat spaghetti bolognese, she'll eat lasagna, but there's something about gravy and mince that is like a massive aversion, and she won't eat it. And the other thing with Maisie as well, it's always been jam. So she won't eat jam. She will not eat donuts. She will not eat yum-yums. It's just something about that specific texture, that kind of thing that she won't eat. It's just a normal thing. It's like my brother, he won't eat tomatoes. He'll eat tinned tomatoes, but he won't eat fresh tomatoes. And I told him he's an idiot.
Yeah, but then that just proves, doesn't it? Like, at some point, everyone's got something, you know, no one eats everything and anything in the whole world, do they? Everyone's got things they like, things they don't like. And I suppose this is just more of an extreme example. But on some level, we can all relate to being triggered by some foods. Like, you know, like, for instance, I think there's some restaurant that if I go past, I think, oh, Jesus, that reminds me of my ex-fiancé for a not a good reason. I mean, I don't want to eat in there. Yeah, so you know, it's
that you do places. I have, we have that. We don't ever go anywhere. The entirety of our relationship, we've never been to the same restaurant, bar, or place like out in place where we've been to with ex partners. It's just kind of an agreement that we made when we started going out. But this is the thing. Jake is getting better with his aphid, isn't he? He's not as severe as what he was. But bear in mind what he's been through. That is quite a lot, and it's still not quite over for him yet, is there? I mean, is he going to have a reversal? Is he going to continue life with a stoma? Is he going to potentially have to have anything more done? We're hoping not, but he's still young and he's going into school. And like you said, it's bug season at the moment. So that's not, how do you manage that as a parent? Do you kind of go, oh, it's okay, he's caught gastroenteritis, but we can manage it because I know what I need to do if we hit level 1, 2, or 3.
Yeah. I mean, unfortunately, I think I just know what to do now, and you go on autopilot. It's like, say, if you get a bug, you know what to do for yourself to get yourself out the other end. And it's the same when you've got a kid with a stoma and their output rockets. You just know what to do. He did have an attempt at a reversal and it went drastically wrong. And he ended up in intensive care and he didn't wake up for 8 days. And that was when he was about two. So he can't remember any of that, obviously. And for that very reason, neither the doctors nor us have pushed a reversal at all. But we've always been told, you know, like, the younger they are, the better it will be for them to have a reversal. But he's just been too poorly and had too many bouts of illness to entertain it. But it's now the discussions have crept back into appointments again about a possible reversal. But I mean, I don't know about you, but I had a stoma and then had it as a baby like Jake, but then I had it reversed at 2.5 and it worked and I was left with a J pouch. And then I had a stoma again at the age of 30 during lockdown. But if I could go back and not have that reversal, I would, because it was grim having a J pouch. I mean, no offense to anyone that's had one and had great experiences with them, but for me, it was not the one for me. It wasn't good at all. That's a whole nother podcast. But anyway, so it's quite hard as his mum not to think about my own experiences and think, I don't want him going through the same as me. But ultimately, like I said, he's getting older now. And when the time comes, he will be part of that decision now, because he's getting older and it's his body and he's the one that's going to have to, obviously with my support, I'd do anything for him, but he is the one that's going to have to live with the repercussions, whether they're good or bad. And that is a massive decision as a parent, especially knowing that you've experienced it and experienced it in a bad way, because you don't want to put them in that position to suffer the way you did. But also you don't want to take that chance away from them, because he could have it done and he could skip off into the sunset and live his best life. But then how are you supposed to know, and how are you supposed to make that decision? It's a massive decision. And I don't know what the answer is, to be honest.
Am I correct in thinking that he has a pouch in there at the moment? It's just not used.
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah.
Because there are other issues that you're experiencing with that, aren't you, with the pouch at the moment, because it's not being used.
Yeah. So, I mean, not another thing that's not really discussed a lot is secreting out of the bottom. So it happens to a lot of people who have stomas who are still connected. And people don't, in this world of social media where lots of people like to, how do we say this? Lots of people like to put pictures up that are very flattering with a stoma and not talk about the gross stuff. I, for one, feel like you need to have a bit more of a balance, and there's no point pretending that you don't have secretions if you do, because someone who does, that's genuinely looking for someone to relate to and for support, they're not going to get it, because
the reality of secretions, it doesn't get spoken about enough, though, because diversion colitis is a bad thing. I suffered with it for 2 years after having my temporary stoma placed in 2016. So if I can imagine what that was like for me as an adult with the smell, the consistency, the blood, I dread to think what Jake has to go through with regards to the secretions and the issues that he's having with that at the moment.
Yeah, a lot of people get secretions with a stoma, some people on a big scale, some people not so much. But ultimately, if you have them, you can't really get rid of them. It's just part of it. And for a little one who's never had use of their bottom because they've had a stoma from day dot or washouts, I've had to literally toilet train him to manage them. So I've had to buy a stool for the toilet and a seat to go on top of it so that he can sit in a position where his knees are up, so that he can create, you know what I mean?
No, I know exactly what you mean, because
I mean, I'm doing actions, but these people can't see this. So that's
I've now got that advert with the unicorn poo ice creams going.
Yes, that is, yes, the unicorn. And if anyone hasn't seen that video, you have to see it, because that is the video that I was told to show Jake.
I'm amazed at that chap. I still haven't found the outtakes from them putting that advert together. I'd be amazed.
What's it called? The
Poppy Poppy.
Yeah, it's, yeah, and it's actually, if you go on the Eric website, so Eric is a charity that supports children with stomas and bowel conditions, and they have all the resources there to help toilet train your children. That is a really good point of reference for help as a parent with a child with stoma. And yeah, it's on there. And just trying to get him to sit in the right position, relax, let out whatever's there, and be able to know when it's gone. And then in the day to not ignore it, because as a little boy, you're running around, you're playing football, you're with your mates, you do not want to stop to go to the toilet to think of the unicorn song in your head to get rid of what is in your bottom. You don't want to, do you? So it took a lot of time for trying to get it into his head that it's really important that he does, because if he doesn't, it's just going to come out on its own anyway, eventually. And then that causes a sore bottom. And then it's literally like going back to a baby again and using nappy rash cream. And it's, so yeah, that took a long time. And it's like, if you have a reversal, you know, you'd have to get used to suddenly having all that acidic stool coming out of your bottom that you never had to deal with before. And your skin will have to get used to toughening up and getting used to it passing. And, you know, and it's the same for a kid. And ultimately, as his mum, I can't be looking down his pants to check if he's got a secretion every minute of the day. It's not possible. So then you've got to kind of look for the signs. So if your child does have a stoma and you think they might be secreting and you're not spotting it, the signs I look for and I tell his teachers are itching there, adjusting his underwear, being a bit wriggly and looking a bit uncomfortable, and even going off to the toilet and not telling anyone because he wants to wipe his bum because he knows he's done it. So they're the signs that I always tell the BEMS, the staff that look after him in school. And thankfully, everyone's on top of it, and he knows he's got to do that now. But again, that's just part of it. Yeah, it's just the reality of it, isn't it? Just something else that a little person has to deal with that they shouldn't have to.
Yeah, but he's such a trooper. He's so active and so, like...
You know what I'd like to know, right, is how those men that lift those heavy weights and those body lifters with a stoma, I wonder if they have secretions. And if when they lift those massive weights, what happens?
I don't know, we'd have to ask.
What happens there?
I don't know. I suppose that's something that's never been covered. I mean, I know secretions as a general whole are a thing that doesn't get spoken about, and it's one of them.
But I've never, I mean, I've spoken about it in my stories and that, because after my surgery I was getting it, but I don't get it anymore, to be fair, touch wood, I haven't for
Makes you panic though, doesn't it?
If you've had it before, you get paranoid, yeah, but luckily I think that was just a post-op thing. But yeah, I mean, yeah, no one talks about it at all. And it'd be great if a man talked about it, because I bet men have it. But no one talks about it, do they? Maybe that's an idea for another podcast.
How do you manage with Jake with night times with regards to his bag? Because with the high output, I mean, I know adult perspective of having a high output ileostomy. I saw a poll the other day where somebody was asking about how many times somebody empties their bag. And I was like the 1%. And most people only like empty their bag up to five times a day, sometimes a little bit more. How many times does Jake empty his, and how do you manage that overnight time? Because
So we're quite lucky, really, because I don't have to empty it over the night. It's just in the morning, it definitely needs emptying. But yeah, his body's kind of naturally learned to for the digestive system to shut down and go to sleep and be able to just not need to in the night. But saying that, he doesn't eat a massive amount in the evenings, which probably contributes to it, because I know for me, if I have a meal past 6 o'clock, I'm definitely waking up in the night. Whereas when I first had my surgery, a thing wouldn't pass my lips after six because I was just exhausted and I didn't want to have to wake up lots in the night. Whereas now I'm
don't care, not so bothered. But I know in the early days, I was like, oh my God, the thought of not getting up by accident and being covered in poo was just too much. So I'd whatever. But yeah, no, I think that's not really an issue at the moment. But I'm sure as he gets older and he consumes more,
I mean,
you know, he'll learn to, you know, recognize when he needs to. That's when he's a teenager for sure.
Yeah. I mean, I know from personal experience when I first had my second and third set of surgery and I knew that I was going to have a high output ileostomy for the rest of my life, I was using absorbing sachets in my bag during the day. I was using them of a night time, but I've now kind of just trained myself. I eat before seven. If I do eat anything after seven, I tend to have something snacky, and like the same with my drinks. I know that the last time I'll have a drink will be 10 o'clock because I know it'll be out in my bag by 10:30, which means I can kind of go and settle into bed for 11 o'clock and actually manage to get through till about 5, 5:30, sometimes 6 in the morning, get up, empty my bag, and then have a really bad habit of going back to bed.
Oh, God. Yeah, I mean, I know for like, you know, the one thing for me that helps and has done from when I first knew about them was absorption capsules. I didn't even know they existed until I think I was on the phone crying to, who was I crying to? The company that delivers the stoma stuff. And I think it was just a bad day. He had a bug. The bag, I think I changed his bag like 10 times in one day, and it wasn't even like tea time. And the woman on the end of the phone just said, oh, have you tried absorption capsules? And I was like, no, I don't know what you're on about, don't know what they are. And they literally changed everything. Just so, like, you know, we both got an ileostomy. The consistency is never going to be better than porridge on a good day. And it was just pure green water. Couldn't shut it off. It was like a tap. And it still is now when he's got a bug. And those capsules are the thing that stops it from leaking. For me, when it's that bad and they're that ill, it doesn't matter what bag you've got. Even if you've got the best bag in the world, if it's like tap water and it's pouring and pouring out, you know, it's not, it, you are not going to not have a leak. And those capsules, they're amazing. They just solidify it. It looks gross when you see it. It's like almost like caviar in your bag that you would not want. But yeah, but it totally changes it. And it's, if there's any parent out there that's listening, for God's sake, go through all the websites and get supply samples of absorption capsules, because they are a game changer. Even if you just buy one tub, they're very hard to get on prescription. They don't like giving them out on prescription. But even if you just buy one tub just to keep in the event of emergencies, I tell you, you will not regret buying them.
Why can't they get them on prescription? Because I swear I had mine on script.
I think if you've got a very high output and leaks are part of, you know, your life, then they will give them on prescription. But say you've got a good behaved stoma and you haven't got a crazy high output, the stoma nurses won't deem them as necessary to your day-to-day routine. Whereas for Jake, in his case, it was necessary. For yourself, it's obviously necessary. But for most, it isn't. So they don't like to give them.
It's prescription roulette again, though. My old GP wouldn't give me barrier film spray on my prescription.
Because
I used a barrier ring, they wouldn't give me barrier spray. And I was like, but I'm having issues because of a cyst. It's pushing everything out. Why can't I have the spray? Oh, well, you use a barrier ring, that'll stop it. And I said, yeah, but that doesn't stop my stoma site from having issues. I said, it stops the burning. I said, but it doesn't stop the fact that the cyst is causing leaking because my skin's now like majorly uneven. My new GP, absolutely amazing, rang up my delivery company, explained what was going on. So they put like a massive caveat on my prescription request.
Yeah.
And I got the barrier spray, but I've been fighting my old GP too for months. And yeah, absolutely amazing. But I mean, with Jake's high output, are you managing his skin? Because
that's one thing that I will say is that I hate to take the credit, but I will. His skin is badass. His skin is amazing. It is really good. That is the one thing I feel like I can say I have done right. Out of all of this, I will say that his skin is absolutely beautiful. Yeah, really, really good. To the point where when I had my surgery, I was like, why is my skin not like yours? And he'd look at it and go, ooh, mummy, that looks bad. It's not like mine. I need to rub it in. Yeah, I know.
Yeah, I think you find with high output as a general whole, I don't think it gets a chance to sit on the skin long enough to cause as much damage. It can cause damage, but I don't think it happens as quick as
what. No, it's all me. No. No. It's the mothering. It's the caring. It's
the mothering. Right. Okay. top hashtag mum points.
No, I get what you mean, though. That actually does make a lot of sense, to be fair.
But you also find it eats away the base plate so much more quickly. It's why we need the barrier rings. It's why we need like the sprays, because it just eats everything. It just eats everything.
Yeah. I've changed his bag once a day. And I remember before I had a stoma and I knew much about having a stoma as an adult, I would be gobsmacked when people would tell me they'd have their bag on for like 2-3 days. I'd be like, how? And I'd think I was doing something wrong with Jake. What was I using the wrong products? Was I doing the wrong routine? Whatever. And then as soon as you speak to people like yourselves, you're like, oh, okay. Yeah. It is fine. It's just the way it is. And I've always said I'd rather change his bag once a day and know he's not going to suffer with a leak and be embarrassed in school than try it and go crazy and last a couple of days and just hope it's fine.
Yeah, I think it's just whatever is in that output because of the way it's coming out. It just, you'll know from when you change Jake's bag versus your bag. When you look at the base plate, when you take yours off, you can see a little bit of wear and tear, but you can't see like any like major issues. Whereas when you take Jake's off, that bit around the hole where the material's worn off, it's basically gone see-through.
Yeah, I know. And then you think, oh, and then I think, oh my God, has that been stinging him? Is it hurting him? And like the telltale signs for me when he needs his bag taken off, he'll itch there. He wears a waistband all the time in the day and he'll rearrange his waistband and he'll, you know, all these little telltale signs that I think, right, he doesn't want to be stopped doing what he's doing. He doesn't want his bag changed, but you know he needs it. So that's where you've got to play the meme and kind of be like, right, you just need to stop what you're doing and I need to change your bag.
Do you change his in the morning or do you change his in the evening? Because I know for me, I can never quite control what my output is going to do. So I find first thing in the morning, changing a bag for me is better than doing it in the evening, just purely because it's just going through so quick.
Yeah, now logic would tell you, yes, I should do that. But I am a crap person in the morning. Like it takes me 2 hours to fully function as a human. So I do not do that. I do, not at all. It's in the night. We just kind of got a routine. He'll have a bath and then I'll do his bag and then his story and his bed. And that's kind of what I've always done, to be honest.
But then saying that he's 7, he probably has his dinner at 4, 4:30 in the evening.
Yeah, he has it a lot earlier, yeah. And I suppose, like, I do the same as well because I've always, because of the eating and all the issues with that, they always encourage you to, like, make sure that you always eat with them and, you know, just to model good eating behaviour and that. So also I end up eating early, so then that also helps me not to have full bags in the night. So yeah, it's kind of, you know, it works for us. But, you know, if I'm, you know, out somewhere or stay overnight somewhere and people like book meals for like 7, 8 o'clock, I'm like, sorry, what? That's like a full meal of the day. That's like 3-4 hours after I've last eaten. The one thing I would say to any parent that's listening, if they're struggling, you're not going to find as much help and support in the written form on social media about children for obvious reasons. But please reach out. Like if you're struggling and you want to ask questions, ask them. Like the worst thing that's going to happen is someone's going to not reply or they're going to say no. You never have to see them or meet them or talk to them ever again. It's a lot, I think, especially since having surgery myself as an adult, there's so much support and I've gained so much from being in this community online. and I wouldn't be who I am today if I hadn't have met people like yourself. But as a parent with a kid with a stoma, especially if you don't even know what one was until your kid had one, I felt lonely and isolated. So God knows how those parents feel. And if there is an account you follow, just send a message, reach out, because we don't put lots of photos of our kids out there and talk about them a lot for obvious reasons, it doesn't mean we don't want to help. Especially in my case, I will help anyone and everyone.
A massive great big thank you to Rachel for helping and coming on doing the podcast and talking about Jake's journey and a little bit of her own. For any of you wishing to have a look at anything that we may have mentioned within the podcast, if you head over to www.pelicanhealthcare.co.uk, you can have a look at things on there. They do absorbing sachets, which you can put into your bag along with the barrier rings and any films and sprays that we've been talking about whilst doing the podcast. We will be back with another podcast soon. And a big thank you to Rachel. And if we say bye.
Bye.